Yao 2011 with Bjorn Freeman Benson. Tell us a little bit about where you work and what you do.
So I'm the Vice President of Engineering at New Relic, and we're a software as a service web application performance monitoring company.
Nice.
So what we do is our, you know, sort of the large picture view is that we're trying to make the web a faster place. And what we're really trying to do is we're trying to make your ability to make the web a faster place. So we monitor your application and your servers and your end users and so on and tell you where the performance problems are in that.
Excellent.
And prior to taking on the Vice President of Engineering role, I was one of the engineers there, and I loved the job there because there's sort of three parts to the application. One is the little agents that get stuck into people's applications. Then there's the data collectors that collect the data from the agents. And then there's the main web application that you see when you go to the site and you look into it. I'm a compiler language guy from way back. You know, when I was working on my PhD thesis, I wrote my own Lisp interpreter so that I could do the work I was interested in doing.
Nice.
And so on. Right. So when I joined New Relic, I said, well, one of the things I want to do is I want to work on one of those agents. And so I worked on the PHP agent. I figured out how to instrument the PHP virtual machine, reaching into the pieces of the virtual machine that we need to gather information out of and do it in a really low overhead way. So it was a completely geeky way to get involved in the company.
Excellent.
And since then, we've grown. I think when I joined, there were 8 people, and now we're about 80 people.
Wow.
And so I've taken on the role of managing the engineering organization as a whole and all of those separate teams.
Excellent. Now, what, in terms of, since you have, with web applications, you have to rely on things like client performance, server-to-server performance, then this whole cloud stuff. How does it work?
Yeah, so, you know, maybe you should be on this side of the camera because, like, you've got it all down. So, no, what we do
is... Not at all.
No, but you've got the picture exactly, which is what we do is we have a little agent that sits in each of those different layers.
Okay.
So at the server layer, we have a little daemon that sits there on your server and gathers some statistics and some, you know, various pieces of information and sends that information up to us once a minute. And in your application, we have, if you're a Ruby application, we have a gem. If you're a Java application, we have a jar. If you're a PHP application, we have a PHP extension. We've got Python. We've got .NET. Anyway, any one of these things. We have a little agent that goes in and instruments certain aspects of your application. And then based on, you know, what it's gathering, it sends the information back once a minute. And then because we're in the web application itself, we know when you're generating HTML, and so we insert a little bit of JavaScript into the output of the HTML so that then we can measure on the browser rendering time, the network response time on the whole way. So we've got the whole stack from the end users through the application and down to the servers. Mm. And then, of course, all that data comes to our collectors where we collect it and store it in databases, and then we can show it back to you in this little charts, and we have alerts and you know, all the sort of things that you would imagine. And then we have, you know, design guys who make it look good and things like that. But like I said, I'm more of a language geek, so
excellent.
I prefer the virtual machine side of things.
Excellent. And speaking of virtual machines, when you think about most apps, like, for example, Channel 9, we run in Azure. So we're running in a virtual machine, any number of virtual machines all over the place in data centers.
Yeah, now I'm talking about, like, the JVM virtual machine.
Got it.
I mean, you can run our application, of course, on any stack, right? Whether it's a virtual stack in the cloud or actual, you know, hardware, or you can run on your developer laptop, you can run it in, you know, giant sunboxes if you still happen to have one of those from the 80s, you know, whatever. So, you know, you could, that sort of virtualization doesn't matter, right? The interesting thing is for the applications, what I'm talking about is like the JVM. How do you instrument the JVM?
Mm.
You know, so, you know, for you instrumenting the JVM, you want to do something like you want to handle the web request call, right? So what we do is we take the web request call and then we figure out when that's loaded, and we go and modify the bytecodes, and we essentially put a try, catch, finally block around that.
Okay.
And at the top, we start a timer, and at the end, we stop the timer, and then that's how long we know how long that particular function took. And of course, if we do that for a set of the functions throughout the application, then we can measure what the time performance of sort of a tree of bits is.
Mm.
Now, in order to keep that efficient, you have to do that in a way where you measure only a selected set of those things. So I call it curated instrumentation. So we don't instrument everything, because if you instrument everything, then the overhead's too high to run in production. And what we've discovered is you got to run this stuff in production. Because if you run it in a test environment, all you're going to do is look at the performance and the errors and so on that happen in your test environment, what you could possibly come up with in your test environment.
Mm.
And what we've discovered is that real users are unbelievably creative in how they can bring your system down and cause problems.
Yeah.
And so you really want to run it in production. But to do that, we have to keep the overhead under about 5%.
Interesting. Right. So what do you make of things like Node.js, and do you have sort of a story there?
We don't have a story for Node.js. So far we haven't had a lot of customers who've asked for Node.js. Node.js is interesting because it's not quite the same model of request and response. And so the question is, how do you want to measure that in a way which provides useful information back to the developers and the people who are operating the system as to what the problem is going on there? Mm. And I think that the Node.js, you know, it's one of these things where we're going to have to move as a software industry towards that sort of thing. But, you know, you can tell by the color of my hair, I've been in the industry for a while. We've had to move towards that sort of thing for a long time, and we haven't yet done it. Right?
Okay.
Sort of every decade, there's something that we got to do as an industry, but we don't seem to do. And we continue to just make faster processors. So now we're going, you know, horizontally across many machines to compensate for the fact that we don't really know how to program in parallel.
Mm-hmm.
And someday we'll send kids to universities and they'll learn how to program in parallel, and then they'll come out and we'll do that. Mm-hmm. Today, everybody learns how to program sequentially. And so we're sort of stuck in this sequential model, and you know, it's almost a self-reinforcing loop.
Absolutely.
So, you know, that's what I think. I think Node is one of those things that could break us out of that, but it hasn't yet. And I think a lot of the problem is that people don't really understand how to program in that model, mm-hmm. where it's not a direct imperative sequential model.
Interesting. Well, you know, that's for sure. I was talking to Simon Payton-Jones not too long ago, and we were talking about that, you know, universities and curriculums need to step up to the plate a little more, and not just the Carnegie Mellons of the world, but also, you know, the standard universities where, you know, most people will end up going, need to start teaching how to think parallel, program parallel, maybe forget about always going towards Java to learn how to program and choose something else, maybe like Haskell. Now, of course, I was talking to Simon Payton-Jones.
Yeah.
But thinking functionally is important in the future.
Yeah, so I was a university professor for a while before I became back to being an engineer. And the course that I loved teaching was the Survey of Programming Languages course, because I would teach them, I think it was, 9 different programming languages in 9 weeks sort of thing.
Nice.
Right? And so each of the languages that I chose was an abstraction of a certain type, whether you abstracted control structures, you abstracted arrays, or you abstracted objects, or whatever, you know, abstracted infinite computation. Hmm. Right? And so the idea was to show people that you could think in many different ways about the problem. It wasn't just whatever the current hot programming language, which at the time was C++, was, right, or today it's Java. You know, it's like, oh, well, we're going to do Java, we're going to do Ruby. That teaches you one particular way to think, but there's many different ways to abstract that. In fact, you know, the keynote this morning at the conference was just fabulous, because Damien was talking about all these different ways to think about programming forward in time, backwards in times, and so on, all which, of course, he was doing with Perl, because, you know, that's who he is.
Yeah.
But, you know, the idea was there's different abstractions where you can think about doing those same computations.
Right? Mm.
And so Node is one of those things where you're thinking about the computation in a different way than we are in a standard programming model that we've got today.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then, you know, for a company like New Relic, the interesting question is, well, how would we monitor that if you were programming in a different way, right?
Exactly.
And, you know, we got smart guys. We'll figure that out. I don't have an answer for you right now how we would, you know, let's say you wanted to write your web applications in Prolog, right? Of course, nobody writes in Prolog anymore, but there's another different model, right? Well, how would you monitor that in a way where you could get useful feedback about what was slow from a Prolog engine? Well, it certainly wouldn't be any of the classical models that we use today, like sampling profilers or, you know, timing certain sections of the code or something, because it just doesn't match the Prolog model.
Interesting, yes. Now, do you survey native code? So C++, C, there's C++ running on the server. Think of Facebook, their back end is C++.
Yeah, so we don't, because, I mean, there's nothing to stop you from monitoring at that. It's just that the model we've adopted as a company is that we go and automatically instrument your code.
Right? I see.
So you throw our jar in the jar file place, right? And it intercepts the class loader, and it figures out every class you're loading, and it figures out the interesting classes and methods, you know, the ones that we've curated and the ones that you've selected. And then we bytecode rewrite those, and then we send them off to the loader, right? Mm. But what we do is, you know, we've selected the ones that we're looking for there. And so you don't have to do any work. You just throw that jar file in, and it works, right?
Nice.
So if you wanted to do that for native code, we would either have to know what library you're using and find a way to hook into it, or, you know, force you to go and add the annotations yourself and
sure.
so on, which are other ways to do it. It's just not the model we've chosen.
That's right. Really cool. Now, for you, of course, you mentioned you I mean, you're doing it for Java, should be doing it for C Sharp and .NET as well, right?
Yeah, we got C Sharp, we got .NET.
Cool.
Yeah.
And in that case, how does that work? You just what file do I put it in somewhere?
So we have an installer because the Microsoft stuff is a little bit more complicated because you have to adjust the registry and so on.
Okay.
But we use the debug hook in the CLR runtime. And so then we basically pretend that we're a debugger, but we don't trap all of the debug functions in there because we don't want to trap every single statement execution and so on. We're just a few of them. So we just trap this load hook in there so that when you load in a new assembly, we can go in and modify, again, with bytecode rewriting, the particular things that we need.
That's excellent.
You know, and it's interesting. There's interesting things in the CLR, you know, because when it was designed, they had, you know, long jumps and short jumps. And, of course, so if you're adding code in the bytes in the middle of this thing and there was a short jump over it, but now the short jump is more than 256 or whatever the right number is long, then you have to make it into a long jump, which uses more bytes. And, you know, for again, for compiler VM geeks like me, that's fun stuff, right?
Yeah, right on. That's cool. Now, in some sense, JavaScript on the client is becoming, you know, HTML5 is sort of the very important thing these days for client authoring of applications. Have you seen many really super large JavaScript applications in the real world that you have to instrument?
Well, you know, I guess the question is what's super large? You know, when we first started writing JavaScript code, you know, anything over like 12 lines was super large.
So thousands, tens of thousands.
Yeah, so we're seeing that kind of application out there. In fact, I think our application is tens of thousands of lines of JavaScript to make it act like a real application. I mean, people, you know, what people want when they go to a website these days isn't static pages that refresh. They want an application experience. And the only way to get that is to write a serious amount of JavaScript.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a number of ways you can do that. You can use frameworks and so on. And I don't think that, you know, in my opinion, none of them are particularly good at this point. But, you know, there are people out there who are writing a lot of JavaScript.
And this is true.
They want to know what it performs like. And what they really want to know is what the user's experience is. Because, you know, you can do a lot of asynchronous stuff in the background with Ajax and so on. It doesn't matter if the page comes up quickly, but then it does a lot of processing in the background, people don't really care about that. So you don't want to report that in say, our monitoring stuff as saying the page is slow. Because to the user's perception, it's not. The page came up quickly. On the other hand, if it's the other way around, where, for instance, the server sent a payload over the original JavaScript very quickly, and then that JavaScript went into a bunch of asynchronous loads or synchronous loads of other stuff before it finally rendered the page, you want to report the page render time, you know, from when the user clicked the button to when they actually saw it, because that's what the users are caring about, right? So it doesn't matter sort of from a technical point of view that the network was really fast if the user still perceives the application to be slow, right?
This is true. And then, of course, there's the issue of the DOM in a browser, which is independent completely of JavaScript speed.
Yes.
And that's a whole other ball of wax.
And each of the browsers has different speed, you know, and different characteristics there. And,
yeah.
So, you know, I don't envy the engineers who work on the team who make our application work on all those browsers. I mean, they do a great job. You know, it's just not where my heart is, but I'm glad they're good at it. Right?
Yeah. So what do you think of this movement to the cloud? There was some talks here at Yahoo about, you know, you must learn and start thinking about how to transition to the cloud and stuff like that, which is, of course, important for you, too. I mean, because you're going to want to be able to tell a developer that, you know, would be nice to alert a developer that, hey, you might want to spin up some more nodes. We're seeing that you're having some issues here, blah, 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 you know, whatever. So what's your thought on the cloud story?
So to me, the cloud is the same thing, but sort of in one way better than the thing before. So, you know, when you say you got to spin up more nodes, if, for instance, your data center that you were serving the stuff out of had spare machines and you weren't on the cloud, just were on machines, it would be easy to spin up spare additional machines, right? So the fact that you want to, say, spin up more machines isn't limited to the cloud. It's just a characteristic of, is there more resources available? And, you know, if you work in a big enough company, like, you know, I worked for Amazon for a while, they had a lot of machines, and so you could ask for some more machines, and the data center guys just had more machines sitting around because they knew that people were going to ask for more machines, right? So you didn't have to have a cloudiness to do that particular thing. I think what the cloud does for you, though, is it makes that transaction very, very low cost, right? So you could imagine, again, let's say if you were in a big company like IBM or Amazon or some eBay, where you had some sort of quick way as a developer to ask for more machines, whether they were virtual machines or non-virtual machines. Just, you know, go to a website and say, I need four more machines. You get back a key and you've got four more machines, right? So in some sense, it looks like the cloud to you, but it doesn't really matter whether they're physical machines or virtual machines. So I think that's what the cloudiness does for you, is it makes that transaction very, very low. And when it makes that transaction very, very low, it allows you to do all sorts of interesting experiments. Like a friend of mine in Portland was saying, well, we wanted to run some data analysis, but we didn't want to buy 100 machines to do that data analysis. So we just spun up a bunch of Amazon instances to do all that computation, and then after a few hours, we threw them all away, right? And it's that sort of sharing across multiple organizations that's enabled by this cloud aspect, as opposed to it being fundamentally different than what we were doing before, right? And so I just think it's lowering the transaction cost of doing that, which then enables interesting things you can do.
Certainly. Well, I mean, computation as a service is kind of cool too, right? So
yeah.
Go ahead, here's a big problem, solve it for me and, you know, whatever.
Well, that's one of the things that I thought was cool about the first version of Azure that they were putting together, where they sort of, they said, well, you can run it here, you can run it there, you can run it lots of places at once. You know, you don't really have to think about that. I'm like, oh yeah, that's fabulous, you know. That's the way you want to go. You just want to say, you know, I want to do a bunch of computation. Right?
Exactly.
And then, you know, I was imagining all sorts of things you could do with that. You could say, well, I want to pay a lot because I want it in a hurry. Mm-hmm. Or I don't want to pay a lot and I'm okay with it taking a while, right? You know, and then, you know, we're back to the days of the mainframe where, you know, you schedule your jobs for midnight or you schedule your jobs for 5 p.m. But, you know, it's just a bigger version of the same thing. But, you know, I thought that was a really neat way that Microsoft was going with their technology because, you know, you don't have to think about the details of it. You just write a bunch of code and you say, now run it. Right.
Sure. Now, you use the past tense. Of course, we're still going that direction.
Well, the thing is, I'm never quite clear exactly where Azure is, right? Whether it's a, you know, Heroku-like thing for .NET, or whether it's a computation-like thing where you just give it a bunch of computation and you don't worry about the details. And I have to admit, the marketing from Microsoft's a little vague there.
Well, I mean, fair enough. I would argue we're an engineering company, not a marketing
company.
Exactly. with all due respect to our wonderful marketing people, but we're engineers first and foremost. So from an engineering perspective, you're spot on. I mean, it is, you know, computation as a service, elastic computation as a service. And beyond that, I don't work on the Azure team. I'll let them tell you. But I'll give them that feedback. Actually, they'll watch it as it's happening.
There you go.
I'll tell them to watch this video. But that's a really good point. But
I think, you know, and here I'm just giving you guys advice.
Right.
That's one of the neat things that Microsoft has over some of the other competitive services is you have that ability to make that computation as a service, right? Whereas many of the other places are like platform as a service, which is another, you know, it's a step up from infrastructure as a service, which is a step up from doing it yourself, right?
Absolutely. So we'll see where that goes. You know, of course, cloud computing is in the first 5 minutes of the first quarter.
Right.
That's a good way to think about it. And that was actually something, a quote I had stolen from a colleague at Microsoft. But at any rate, so in this world of, you know, multi-core and many-core, what kind of burden does it add to you to be able to understand, to be able to automatically understand what code is doing wrong that's running on a system of, in reality, let's say 10 cores at this point, because who knows when 100 cores is going to happen on the client CPUs is what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So how do you detect, you know, you have a bottleneck here because you're not taking advantage of the underlying power that's afforded to you. I mean, how deep do you go?
Well, so there's two answers to that question.
Great. Right?
One is, you know, as an engineer, how would I understand that? And the other one is, as New Relic as a product that we have, how do we understand
yes.
that? And as New Relic as a product, we don't do that analysis for you. What we do is we tell you, you know, here's what your application is slow. It's slow in its database. It's slow in its view generation. It's slow on this server, but not on this server. It's slow in the data communication between the servers. But we don't, you know, again, because we're doing curated instrumentation in order to keep the overhead low, we don't go all the way down to all the details of the application. So, for instance, I don't know what queuing mechanism you use inside your code, and therefore whether that queuing mechanism is going to scale to 10 processors or 100 processors, right? As an engineer, you're going to have to look at the data that we provide you and say, I see what the problem is here. Look, it's as we increase load and we increase the number of servers, we're not getting a linear increase in our and our perform or linear decrease in our performance. So we must have a queuing problem, you know, or a locking problem in the database or something.
Right.
So there's a limit to how far I can go and remain performant in terms of how I monitor your application.
Sure. Right?
So, you know, if you use other tools where, say, you do a full profile or something that you wouldn't want to use in production, but you use in development, and you instrument the heck out of the thing, and then you run a lot of load on it, you might be able to find those things, right?
Sure. Now, what about the second part of the question? You, as the compiler geek, the virtual machine geek, what do you think of this concurrency problem?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating as an engineer because, you know, it's forcing me to learn sort of new ways of thinking about the problem. Because it used to be I didn't have to think about whether I was locking a data structure or not, right? It's like I was thinking back a while ago, you know, when I first started writing code and I first started building my own computers and so on, right? Memory was really precious. I mean, I remember when I bought a 2K static memory chip and it was like, it cost me a fortune and I had 2K of static memory, right? And then, you know, sometime in the last few years, I realized that memory is basically free and disk space is basically free and CPU cycles are basically free. I mean, yeah, we're still paying for them, but effectively they're free. And so all those tricks I learned about how to make an algorithm really, really small and really, really compact and so on actually aren't that useful anymore, right? Because at least for, you know, server type applications and workstation type applications. Now, again, on a mobile phone, and the story's a little bit different, although, again, still things are advancing very rapidly there as well. But, you know, the tricks about, well, do I want to compact my data structure using bit fields in C to save a few bytes of memory used to be important, and now it's no longer important, right? Mm. I mean, I just use ints, right? As long as I'm not creating huge amounts of data. Now, again, you know, the people who are doing big data and the people who are doing, you know, that kind of data warehousing thing, they have a different set of problems. I'm not talking about those people. Mm. I'm talking about just sort of basic engineering of web applications, right?
Sure.
It's just free. So the same thing now goes with the concurrency stuff. You know, I didn't used to have to think about that. So my training and my model just isn't around that. And so now I have to learn, well, how am I going to debug those concurrency problems? How am I going to find out when I'm writing my algorithm exactly where the conflicts are? Yeah. I think this is fascinating, forcing me to learn new stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm beginning to more and more like the notion of the solution to the concurrency problem is to not have a concurrency problem. What I mean by that is, like, use the right tools. So, shared nothing.
Yeah,
right?
You know, functional programming.
Yes.
Right. You can get all sorts of benefits from that, but, it requires you to think about the problem in a different way.
Agreed.
Right. And so, to me, that's interesting.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Right on. So your talk here at Yale 2011, why don't you tell us a little bit about what it's going to be, because actually we caught you before.
Exactly. So what I'm talking about is how we use the New Relic product to monitor our own deployments of the New Relic product.
Hmm.
And what's interesting about it is, I don't know, if you talked to, let's see, the two guys who did the six decades of...
Guy Steele and... No.
No, there were two speakers here.
Oh, today?
Yesterday.
Okay.
Anyway, you know, in their talk, they were equating agile development to six decades of engineering development.
Ah.
Right? And in it, they use the space program as one of their examples. And I thought it was interesting because I also use the space program, the American space program, as one of my examples.
Uh-huh.
And so I have a bunch of examples from the American space program of certain events that happened, and they managed to recover from them because of their ability to use monitoring, which, of course, is what we do at New Relic. And so I'm equating those things back to the way we're doing it so you can see the actual advantage to monitoring your stuff in live production.
Sure. Now, that brings up a good point. Your software needs to be excruciatingly reliable. So you don't want to go down when your whole purpose is to help people understand when something of theirs goes down or why something of theirs went down. How do you keep your stuff really reliable?
Well,
maybe I'm wrong by making that assumption. But.
So, I mean, you're right and you're wrong, right?
Okay.
So the agents that sit in your application has to be unbelievably reliable. Mm. Because if we ever take your application down, you'll just throw us out the door. I mean, mm-hmm. there's no way you're going to rely on a service that's crashing your application,
yeah.
right? Our web service, on the other hand, that collects the data and reports on the data, doesn't have to be as reliable, right? Now, again, if you're having a production problem and you come to our site to find out about it and we're not up, you're going to be kind of annoyed, right? But the web has its inconsistencies, and you might just refresh the page a second time and have it come back again.
Sure.
So the servers we have don't have to be as reliable. Now, but the way that we do it is that we found is that we monitor our own stuff. We prefer to think of it as drinking our own champagne.
Great. Right?
And so we use that as a feedback cycle to keep ourselves in good shape. And I have a number of examples of those in the talk about how you make sure that you keep the performance up for the users. And, you know, you watch for the errors that are happening and so on. And it's a continuous. I mean, we do tests. We run unit tests. We run system tests. We run functional tests. You know, we do all that kind of stuff, the stuff that you expect good engineering organizations to do. Mm-hmm. But we found that that's not enough. Right. Mm-hmm. For example, Atlassian is one of our customers. They have lots and lots of servers. Their Atlassian On Demand product uses our New Relic service to monitor it. And they send us a lot of data. And we hadn't designed the system to handle quite that many applications at once. And so they were finding that the pages were getting really slow. Mm-hmm. And we found that because our monitoring of our own stuff was showing us that for certain customers, the page times were getting really, really long. Mm-hmm. So then we went and looked and we said, oh, look, that's the Atlassian ones. It's because they have 5,000 applications. And we need to go over the data in a different way than a straight linear list. And then we go and change it, brought it back to reasonable performance.
Excellent.
So that's our basic strategy. I mean, you know, in some sense, that's what we're selling to people, is that you should be doing that. But we also do the same thing ourselves.
Awesome. Well, I really love that expression, drinking our own champagne. I mean, at Microsoft, we say eating our own dog food.
Yeah,
we call it dog fooding.
I wouldn't eat dog food. So.
Rock and roll, man. I'm going to pass that by. Maybe we can start a new thing. I might have to steal that from you.
There you go.
I like that. Well, hey, thanks for coming on Channel 9.
You bet. Thanks
a lot.
All
right, man. And great. Good luck with your talk today, and good luck with your company.
Thank you.
Sounds really interesting. Cheers.